I laughed, thinking of the dignified Lama Minyadon upscurrying. He smiled at me and continued. Late that night I thought about it. I thought, why shouldn't I touch a ghost? The more I thought about it, the more determined I was that I would touch one. I laid my plans carefully, and read all the old scripts about such matters. I also consulted a very, very learned man who lived in a cave high in the mountains. He told me much. He put me on the right path, and I am going to tell you the same, because it leads directly to the theme of touching a ghost. He poured himself some more tea and sipped a while before continuing. Life, as I told you, consists of a mass of particles, little worlds circling around little suns. The motion generates a substance which, for want of a better term, we will call electricity. If we eat sensibly, we can increase our rate of vibration. A sensible diet, none of the crank cult ideas, increases one's health, increases one's basic rate of vibration. So we come nearer to the ghost's rate of vibration. He stopped and lit a fresh stick of incense. Satisfied that the end was glowing satisfactorily, he turned his attention again to me. The sole purpose of incense is to increase the rate of vibration of the area in which it is burned, and the rate of those within that area. By using the correct incense, for all are designed for a certain vibration, we can attain certain results. For a week I held myself to a rigid diet, one which increased my vibrational frequency. For that week also I continually burned the appropriate incense in my room. At the end of that time I was almost out of myself. I felt that I floated rather than walked. I felt the difficulty of keeping my astral form within my physical. He looked at me and smiled as he said, "You would not have appreciated such a restricted diet." No, I thought, I would rather touch a square meal than any good ghost. At the end of the week, said the Lama my guide, I went down to the inner sanctuary and burned more incense while I implored a ghost to come and touch me. Suddenly I felt the warmth of a friendly hand on my shoulder. Turning to see who was disturbing my meditation, I almost jumped straight out of my robe when I saw that I was being touched by the spirit of one who had died more than a year ago. The Lama Minyadon upstopped abruptly, then laughed out loud as he thought of that long past experience. "Lobsang!" he exclaimed at last. The old dead Lama laughed at me and asked me why I had gone to all that trouble, when all I had to do was to go into the astral. I confess that I felt mortified beyond measure to think that such an obvious solution had escaped me. Now, as you well know, we do go into the astral to talk to ghosts and nature people. Of course, you spoke by telepathy, I remarked, and I do not know of any explanation for telepathy. I do it, but how do I do it? You ask the most difficult questions, Lobsang, laughed my guide. The simplest things are the most difficult to explain. Tell me, how would you explain the process of breathing? You do it, everyone does it, but how does one explain the process? I nodded glumly. I knew I was always asking questions, but that was the only way to get to know things. Most of the other Chelas were not interested. As long as they had their food and not too much work, they were satisfied. I wanted more, I wanted to know. The brain, said the Lama, is like a radio set, like the device which that man Marconi is using to send messages across the oceans. The collection of particles and electrical charges which constitutes a human being, has the electrical, or radio, device of the brain to tell it what to do. When a person thinks of moving a limb, electric currents race out along the appropriate nerves to galvanize the muscles into the desired action. In the same way, when a person thinks, radio or electrical waves, actually they come from the higher part of the radio spectrum, are radiated from the brain. Certain instruments can detect the radiations and can even chart them into what the Western doctors term alpha, beta, delta, and gamma lines. I nodded slowly. I had already heard of such things from the medical lamas. Now, my guide continued, sensitive persons can detect these radiations also, and can understand them. I read your thoughts, and when you try, you can read mine. The more two people are in sympathy, in harmony, with each other, the easier it is for them to read these brain radiations which are thoughts. So we get telepathy. Twins are often quite telepathic to each other. Identical twins, where the brain of one is a replica of the other, are so telepathic each to the other that it is often difficult indeed to determine which one originated a thought. "Respected sir," I said, "as you know, I can read most minds. Why is this? Are there many more with this particular ability?" "You, Lobsang," replied my guide, "are especially gifted and specially trained. Your powers are being increased by every method at our command, for you have a difficult task in the life ahead of you." He shook his head solemnly, "A difficult task indeed. In the old days, Lobsang, mankind could commune telepathically with the animal world. In the years to come, after mankind has seen the folly of wars, the power will be regained. Once again man and animal will walk in peace together, neither desiring to harm the other." Below us a gong boomed and boomed again. There came the blare of trumpets, and the Lama Miniadon up jumped to his feet, saying, "We must hurry, Lobsang, the temple service is about to commence, and His Holiness himself will be there." I hastily rose to my feet, rearranged my robe, and rushed after my guide, now far down the corridor and almost out of sight. Chapter 2. The great temple seemed to be a living thing. From my vantage point, high in the roof, I could look down and see the whole vast extent of the place. Earlier in the day my guide, the Lama Miniadon Dup, and I had journeyed to this place on a special mission. Now the Lama was closeted with a high dignitary, and I, free to wander, had found this priestly observation post amid the mighty rafters which supported the roof. Prowling about on the walkway of the roof, I had discovered the door and daringly pushed it open. No loud shout of wrath greeting the action, I peeped inside. The place was empty, so I entered and found myself in a small stone room, like a cell built into the stone of the temple wall. Behind me was the small wooden door, stone walls on either side, and before me a stone ledge perhaps 3 feet high. Silently I moved forward and knelt so that only my head was above the stone ledge. I felt like a god in the heavens peering down on the lowly mortals, peering down on the dim obscurity of the temple floor so many feet below. Outside the temple the purple dusk was giving way to darkness. The last rays of the sinking sun would be fading behind the snow-covered peaks, sending iridescent showers of light through the perpetual spume of snow flying from the very highest ranges. The darkness of the temple was relieved, and in places intensified, by hundreds of flickering butter lamps. Lamps which shone as golden points of light, yet still diffused a radiance around. It looked as if the stars were at my feet instead of over my head. Weird shadows stole silently across mighty pillars, shadows now thin and elongated, now short and squat, but always grotesque and bizarre, with the cross-lighting making the usual seem unearthly, and the unusual strange beyond description. I peered, staring down, feeling as if in a half-world, uncertain of what I was seeing and what I was imagining. Between me and the floor floated clouds of blue incense smoke rising in layer after layer, reminding me even more of the viewpoint of a god looking down through the clouds of the earth. Gently rising clouds of incense swirled thickly from the censers swung by young and devout chelas. Up and down they paced, silent of foot and immobile of face. As they turned and turned again, a million points of light reflected from the golden censers and sent forth dazzling beams of light. From my vantage I could look down and see the red glowing incense as, fanned by the breeze, it at times almost flared into flames and sent off showers of red, fast-dying sparks. Given fresh life, the incense smoke rose in thicker columns of blue to form trailing paths above and behind the chelas. Rising higher, the smoke formed yet another cloud within the temple. Wreathing and twisting on the faint air currents from moving monks, it seemed like a thing alive, like a creature, dimly seen, breathing and turning in sleep. For a while I gazed, becoming almost hypnotized with the fantasy that I was inside a living creature, watching the lift and sway of its organs, listening to the sounds of the body, of life itself. Through the gloom, through the clouds of incense smoke, I could see the serried ranks of lamas, trappers, and chelas. Sitting cross-legged upon the floor they stretched in their endless rows until they became invisible in the farthest recesses of the temple. All in their robes of order they appeared as a living, rippling patchwork of familiar color. Gold, saffron, red, brown, and a very faint sprinkling of gray, the colors seemed to come alive and float into each other as their wearers moved. At the head of the temple sat His Holiness, the Inmost One, the 13th incarnation of the Dalai Lama, the most revered figure in the whole of the Buddhist world. For a time I watched, listened to the chant of the deep-voiced lamas accented by the high treble of the small chelas. Watched the incense clouds vibrate in sympathy with the deeper vibrations. Lights flickered into darkness and were replaced, incense burned low and was replenished in a shower of red sparks. The service droned on and I knelt there and watched. Watched the dancing shadows grow and die upon the walls, watched the glittering pinpoints of light until I hardly knew where I was nor what I was doing. An aged lama, bent under the weight of years far beyond the normal span, moved slowly before his brothers of the order. Around him hovered attentive trappers, with sticks of incense and a light at hand. Bowing to the Inmost One, and turning slowly to bow to each of the four corners of the earth, he at last faced the assembly of monks within the temple. In a surprisingly strong voice for so aged a man, he chanted, "Hear the voices of our souls. This is the world of illusion. Life on earth is but a dream that, in the time of the life eternal, is but the twinkling of an eye. Hear the voices of our souls, all you that are sore depressed. This life of shadow and sorrow will end, and the glory of the life eternal will shine forth on the righteous. The first stick of incense is lit that a troubled soul may be guided." A trapper stood forth and bowed to the Inmost One before turning slowly and bowing in turn to the four corners of the earth. Lighting a stick of incense, he turned again and pointed with it to the four corners. The deep-voiced chant rose again and died, to be followed by the high treble of the young chelas. A portly lama recited certain passages, punctuating them by ringing his silver bell with a vigor occasioned only by the presence of the Inmost One. Subsiding into silence, he looked covertly around to see if his performance had obtained due approval. The aged lama stepped forward once more, and bowed to the Inmost One into the stations. Another trapper hovered at ready attention, over-anxious in the presence of the head of the state and religion. The aged lama chanted, "Hear the voices of our souls. This is the world of illusion. Life on earth is the testing, that we may be purified of our dross and soar ever upwards. Hear the voices of our souls, all you that are in doubt. Soon the memory of the earth life will pass away, and there will be peace, and release from suffering. The second stick of incense is lit that a doubting soul may be guided." The chanting of the monks below me increased and swelled again as the trapper lit the second stick and went through the ritual of bowing to the Inmost One and pointing the incense to each corner in turn. The walls of the temple appeared to breathe, to sway in unison with the chanting. Around the aged lama ghostly forms gathered, those who had recently passed from this life without the preparation, and who now wandered unguided, and alone. The flickering shadows seemed to leap and writhe like souls in torment. My own consciousness, my perceptions, my feelings even, flickered between two worlds. In the one I peered with rapt attention at the progress of the service beneath me. In the other I saw the between worlds where the souls of the newly departed trembled in fear at the strangeness of the unknown. Isolated souls, clad in dank, clinging darkness, they wailed in their terror and loneliness. Apart from each other, apart from all others because of their lack of belief, they were as immobile as a yak stuck in a mountain bog. Into the sticky darkness of the between worlds, relieved only by the faint blue light from those ghostly forms, came the chanting, the invitation, of the aged lama, "Hear the voices of our souls. This is the world of illusion. As man died in the greater reality that he might be born on earth, so must he die on earth that he may be reborn again to the greater reality. There is no death, but birth. The pangs of death are the pangs of birth." The third stick of incense is lit that a soul in torment may be guided. Into my consciousness came a telepathic command, "Lobsang. Where are you? Come to me now." Jerking myself back to this world by a great effort, I staggered to my numb feet and tottered out of the little door. "I am coming," respected sir. I thought to my guide, rubbing my eyes, watering in the cold night air after the warmth and incense smoke of the temple, I stumbled and felt my way along high above the ground to where my guide was waiting in a room right over the main entrance. He smiled as he saw me. "My Lobsang," he exclaimed, "you look as if you have seen a ghost." "Sir," I replied, "I have seen several. Tonight, Lobsang, we shall remain here," said the Lama. "Tomorrow we shall go and call upon the state oracle. You should find the experience of interest, but now it is time, first for food, and then for sleep." While we ate, I was preoccupied, thinking of what I had seen in the temple, wondering how this was the world of illusion. Quickly I finished my supper and went to the room allotted to me. Wrapping myself in my robe, I lay down and soon was fast asleep. Dreams, nightmares, and strange impressions plagued me throughout the night. I dreamed that I was sitting up, wide awake, and great globes of something came at me like the dust in a storm. I was sitting up, and from the great distance small specks appeared, growing larger and larger until I could see that the globes, as they were now, were of all colors. Growing to the size of a man's head, they rushed at me and streaked away beyond. In my dream, if it was a dream, I could not turn my head to see where they had gone, there were just these endless globes pouring out of nowhere and rushing on past me to nowhere. It amazed me immensely that none of the globes crashed into me. They looked solid, yet to me they had no substance. With such horrid suddenness that it shook me wide awake, a voice behind me said, "As a ghost sees the stout, solid walls of the temple, so now do you." I shivered in apprehension. Was I dead? Had I died in the night? But why was I worrying about death? I knew that so-called death was merely rebirth. I lay down and eventually fell asleep once more. The whole world was shaking, creaking, and tumbling in crazy manner. I sat up in great alarm, thinking that the temple was falling about me. The night was dark, with only the ghostly radiance of the stars above to shed the merest suspicion of light. Gazing straight ahead of me, I felt my hair rise in fright. I was paralyzed, I could not move a finger, and worse, the world was growing larger. The smooth stone of the walls coarsened and became porous rock from the extinct volcanoes. The holes in the stone grew and grew, and I saw that they were peopled with nightmare creatures which I had seen through the Lama Miniodon Up's good German microscope. The world grew and grew, the frightening creatures grew to ponderous size, becoming so vast with the passage of time that I could see their paws. Larger and larger grew the world, then it dawned on me that I was becoming smaller and smaller. I became aware that a dust storm was blowing. From somewhere behind me, the grains of dust roared by, yet none of them touched me. Rapidly they grew larger and larger. Some of them were as large as a man's head, others were as large as the Himalayas. Yet not one touched me. Still they grew larger until I lost all sense of size, until I lost all sense of time. In my dream I appeared to be lying out among the stars, lying cold and motionless while galaxy after galaxy streaked past me and vanished into the distance. How long I remained thus I cannot say. It seemed as if I lay there throughout eternity. At long, long last a whole galaxy, a whole series of universes swung down directly upon me. "This is the end," I thought vaguely as that multitude of worlds crashed into me. "Lobsang, Lobsang, have you gone to the heavenly fields?" The voice boomed and re-echoed around the universe, rebounding from worlds. Re-echoing from the walls of my stone chamber. Painfully I opened my eyes and tried to get them into focus. Above me was a cluster of bright stars which somehow seemed familiar. Stars which slowly vanished to be replaced by the benign face of the Lama Miniodon Up. Gently he was shaking me. Bright sunlight streamed into the room. A sunbeam illuminated some dust motes, and they flashed with all the colors of the rainbow, "Lobsang. The morning is far advanced. I have let you sleep, but now it is time for you to eat and then we will be upon our way." Wearily I scrambled to my feet. I was out of sorts this morning, my head seemed to be too big for me, and my mind was still dwelling upon the dreams of the night. Bundling my scant possessions into the front of my robe, I left the room in search of Tsampa, our staple food. Down the notched ladder I went, hanging on grimly for fear of falling. Down to where the cook monks were lounging about. "I have come for food," I said meekly. "Food? At this time of the morning? Be off with you," roared the head cook monk. Reaching out, he was about to give me a blow when another monk whispered hoarsely, "He is with the Lama Minya Dondup." The head cook monk jumped as if he had been stung by a hornet, then bellowed to his assistant, "Well, what are you waiting for? Give the young gentleman his breakfast." Normally I should have had enough barley in the leather pouch which all monks carry, but as we were visiting, my supplies were exhausted. All monks, no matter whether chelas, trappers or lamas, carried the leather bag of barley and the bowl from which to eat it. Tsampa was mixed with buttered tea and thus provided the staple food of Tibet. If Tibetan lamasaries printed menus, there would be one word only to print: Tsampa. Somewhat refreshed after my meal, I joined the Lama Minya Dondup and we set off on horseback for the lamasery of the state oracle. We did not talk while journeying. My horse had a peculiar motion which required my full attention if I were to remain in place. As we travelled along the Linkor Road, pilgrims, seeing the high rank of my guide's robes, called to him for blessing. Receiving it, they continued the holy circuit looking as if they were at least halfway to salvation. Soon we walked our horses through the willow grove and came to the stony path leading to the home of the oracle. In the courtyard, monk servants took our horses as thankfully I at last slid to the ground. The place was crowded. The highest lamas had travelled the length and breadth of our country to be present. The oracle was going to get in communication with the powers that ruled the world. I, by special arrangement, by special command of the inmost one, was to be present. We were shown to where we would sleep, I next to the Lama Minya Dondup, and not in a dormitory with many other chelas. As we passed a small temple within the main building, I heard hear the voices of our souls. "This is the world of illusion, sir," I said to my guide when we were alone. "How is this the world of illusion?" He looked at me with a smile. "Well," he replied, "what is real? You touch this wall and your finger is stopped by the stone. Therefore you reason that the wall exists as a solid that nothing can penetrate. Beyond the windows the mountain ranges of the Himalayas stand firm as the backbone of the earth. Yet a ghost, or you in the astral, can move as freely through the stone of the mountains as you can through the air." "But how is that illusion?" I asked. "I had a dream last night which really was illusion. I feel pale even to think of it." My guide, with infinite patience, listened while I told of that dream, and when I had finished my tale he said, "I shall have to tell you about the world of illusion. Not for the moment, though, as we must first call upon the oracle." The state oracle was a surprisingly young man, thin, and of very sickly appearance. I was presented to him and his staring eyes burned straight through me, making tingles of fright race up and down my spine. "Yes. You are the one, I recognize you well," he said. "You have the power within, you shall have the knowledge also. I will see you later." The Lama Minya Dondup, my beloved friend, looked well pleased with me. "You pass every test, Lobsang, every time," he said. "Now come. We will retire to the sanctuary of the gods and talk." He smiled down at me as we walked along. "Talk, Lobsang," he remarked, "about the world of illusion." The sanctuary was deserted, as my guide knew in advance. Flickering lamps burned before the sacred images, causing their shadows to jump and move as though in some exotic dance. Incense smoke spiraled upwards to form a low-lying cloud above us. Together we sat by the side of the lectern from whence the reader would read from the sacred books. We sat in the attitude of contemplation, legs crossed, and fingers entwined. "This is the world of illusion," said my guide, "wherefore we call to souls to hear us, for they alone are in the world of reality. We say, as you well know, hear the voices of our souls. We do not say hear our physical voices. Listen to me, and do not interrupt, for this is the basis of our inner belief. As I shall explain later, People not sufficiently evolved must first have a belief which sustains them, makes them feel that a benevolent father or mother is watching over them. Only when one has evolved to the appropriate stage can one accept this which I shall now tell you. I gazed at my guide, thinking that he was the whole world to me, wishing we could be always together. "We are creatures of the spirit," he said, "we are like electric charges endowed with intelligence. This world, this life, is hell. It is the testing place wherein our spirit is purified by the suffering of learning to control our gross flesh body. Just as a puppet is controlled by strings manipulated by the puppet master, so is our flesh body controlled by strings of electric force from our over-self, our spirit. A good puppet master can create the illusion that the wooden puppets are alive, that they act of their own volition. In the same way we, until we learn better, consider that our flesh body is the only thing that matters. In the spirit-strangling atmosphere of the earth we forget the soul that truly controls us. We think that we do things of our own free will and are answerable only to our conscience. So, Lobsang, we have the first illusion. The illusion that the puppet, the flesh body, is the one that matters." He stopped at the sight of my puzzled expression. "Well?" he asked, "and what troubles you, sir?" I said, "Where are my strings of electric force? I cannot see anything connecting me to my over-self." He laughed as he replied, "Can you see air, Lobsang? Not while you are in the flesh body." Leaning forward he grasped my robe, nearly scaring the life out of me as I stared into his penetrating eyes. "Lobsang," he said sternly, "have all your brains evaporated? Are you really bone from the neck up? Have you forgotten the silver cord, that collection of lines of electric force linking you, here, with your soul? Truly, Lobsang, you are in the world of illusion." I felt my face grow red. Of course I knew about the silver cord, that cord of bluish light which connects the physical body to the spirit body. Many times, when astral traveling, I had watched the cord shimmering and pulsing with light and life. It was like the umbilical cord which connects the mother and the newborn child. Only the child which was the physical body could not exist for a moment if the silver cord was severed. I looked up, my guide was ready to continue after my interruption. "When we are in the physical world we tend to think that only the physical world matters. That is one of the safety devices of the over-self. If we remembered the spirit world with its happiness we would be able to remain here only by a strong effort of will. If we remembered past lives when, perhaps, we were more important than in this life, we should not have the necessary humility. We will have some tea brought in and then I will show you, or tell you, of the life of a Chinaman from his death, to his rebirth and to his death and arrival in the next world." The Lama stretched forth his hand to ring the small silver bell in the sanctuary, then stopped at my expression. "Well?" he asked, "what is your question?"
"Sir," I answered, "why a Chinaman? Why not a Tibetan?"
"Because," he replied, "if I say a Tibetan you will try to associate the name with someone you know, with incorrect results." He rang the bell and a servant monk brought us tea. My guide looked at me thoughtfully. "Do you realize that in drinking this tea we are swallowing millions of worlds?" he asked. "Fluids have a more sparsely molecular content. If you could magnify the molecules of this tea you would find that they roll like the sands beside a turbulent lake. Even a gas, even the air itself is composed of molecules, of minute particles. However, that is a digression, we were going to discuss the death and life of a Chinaman." He finished his tea and waited while I finished mine. "Seng was an old mandarin," said my guide. "His life had been a fortunate one and now, in the evening of that life he felt a great contentment. His family was large, his concubines and slaves many. Even the Emperor of China himself had shown him favors. As his aged eyes peered short-sightedly through the window of his room he could dimly discern the beautiful gardens with the strutting peacocks. Softly to his failing ears came the song of birds returning to the trees as the day grew old. Seng lay back, relaxed upon his cushions. Within himself he could feel the rustling fingers of death loosing his bonds with life. Slowly the blood-red sun sank behind the ancient pagoda.
Slowly old Tseng sank back upon his cushions, a harsh rattling breath hissing through his teeth. The sunlight faded, and the little lamps in the room were lighted, but old Tseng had gone, gone with the last dying rays of the sun. My guide looked at me in order to be sure that I was following him, then continued.